We've got a very special guest here in the studio today on A Little Day Music. We have Dr. Richard Masters. He's a professor at Virginia Tech Department of Music, and he's going to play some music for us. So, Dr. Masters. So, tell me about yourself. Where did you start, and how did you wind up here?
So, I grew up in Rochester, New York, which is the home of the Eastman School. So, I was really lucky in that there was definitely a spirit of music in that town. My father worked at Eastman Kodak for 40 years, and his father worked at Kodak as well. And Eastman Kodak was obviously a huge supporter of the Eastman School. George Eastman lent his name to the school and provided funding in the first few years. And so they do a great job in that town of really supporting music. And so you often get bused from your if you live in a suburb, you get bused into the school to hear, you know, an orchestra play or a band concert or things like that, and they're very good about really reaching out into the surrounding communities. And so I grew up playing the piano, but I also played the viola and the euphonium, just because it was music was, you know, such a terrific thing. It was something that I think for a lot of your listeners, it's something that's a really important part of their life, and it was an important part of mine. And so when it came time to kind of decide what I was going to do for school, I decided that I did want to study music. And there was a teacher at the University of Colorado who had previously taught at Eastman named Bob Spillman. And so a lot of people in Rochester still thought very highly of him. And so I actually just sent a tape and I got a scholarship on the basis of a tape, which is great. I don't know if they do that anymore, but they were doing it at the time. So I lucked out. So I did my undergraduate at the University of Colorado, and then I did my master's at Juilliard and then went back to Rochester for my doctorate at Eastman.
Did you always know in your heart of hearts that the piano was what you were going to play, or did you kind of, like me, I started with trumpet and then wound up playing all different kinds of instruments? So how did that sort out for you?
Well, when I was 3 years old, my brother was taking part in a Suzuki school, and he's about 2 years older than me, and so he was having his class recital, and they asked the kids, you know, the kids are all sitting in a circle around the piano, and they say, who wants to play? And of course, nobody raises their hands because no one ever does that voluntarily, right? And so I actually raised my hand, even though I wasn't taking lessons, and said, I'll play. And then they actually let me go up and sit at the piano, you know, doodle for a little bit. And then my parents said, okay, he can take lessons, even though they had been told by a teacher, you know, it's better to wait until you're about five to start. And so I was allowed to start when I was three, which was great.
Wow.
Yeah. And probably now I would give the same advice to most parents, is it's probably better until, you know, they have a good, better attention span to start playing. But it worked out for me, so I would never, I guess, tell people not to start a kid at three.
I'm just wondering what it's like to have experienced such that knowledge at such a young age of how to read the music and how music fits together and how, you know, chord progressions and stuff. I just wonder what to
sure,
a five-year-old mind that must have been like.
Well, I mean, I was three and I didn't know any different, but I actually had an issue very quickly with the so I was being trained in the Suzuki method, and at that point I think
what is the Suzuki method?
So the Suzuki method is a basically a study method that was created by Shinichi Suzuki in Japan. And it was originally intended for a violin, and then it kind of branched out to pretty much all other instruments. And at that time, it was still very much you learn by basically listening. So you're not taught to read music until you're older. And the idea is, you know, you basically learn the mechanics of playing the instrument, and then later they'll teach you how to read music. And that way it's probably a little bit easier on the part of the teacher, because they really can just focus on, you know, your hand has to look like this when you play, your back should be straight, you should be seated a certain way at the piano. And unfortunately for my parents, I said that I was not interested in doing this if it didn't involve learning how to read music. So I think I actually learned to read music probably before I could read text, like read, you know, the English. And I think that now it's a little bit different. I think the Suzuki method is less kind of rigid about that sort of thing. I think at the time they were kind of a little bit dogmatic in terms of, you know, it's better for the student to wait to learn how to read music. And now it's much more, I think they're a little bit more holistic in their education. So we actually switched. I only studied piano with the Suzuki folks for, I think, a year or so. And then I insisted that we find a different teacher who would teach me how to read music. And so my parents, you know, were good sports, and they switched me over.
And now you're teaching at the collegiate level.
Sure, yeah.
Well, you certainly got the background for it.
Yeah, and that's basically what I've wanted to do since I started studying at college. I went to the, like I said, the University of Colorado, which was a terrific environment for a young musician, and I kind of saw how much good music could be made and how it's an easier place to basically be able to make music in a collegiate setting than it is out in the real world. Because in the real world, obviously, you have to gig, you have to do what you need to in order to survive. And if you're lucky, you have time to, you know, be able to focus on music that you really love. But if you work at a university, you're not only teaching the great music, you're also, you have an opportunity to play it. And it's easier to make that happen. And I feel very, very lucky that I have that job.
Speaking of playing, what's the first piece you're going to be playing for us today?
The first piece that I'll play will be Cipressi, which is translated the Cypress Grove, which is by Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco.
Thank you.
Wow, that was something kind of a little Claire de Lune-ish in a way. Or have I got that completely wrong?
So I think you can actually definitely hear a debt that Castelnuovo Tedesco owes to Debussy. The very beginning of the piece, you hear kind of these chords that move up and down the piano in a way very similar to another piece that's on the program, The Sunken Cathedral by Debussy, and I think you can definitely hear Debussy's influence in that. And the interesting thing, I think, is that at the time that Castelnuovo Tedesco was writing, he was considered kind of a bad boy of Italian music, and he wrote quite a bit of music that at the time was kind of dangerous. It was daring, and people would, you know, get up and walk out of concerts, and there's apparently a famous story involving a gentleman sitting in the front row who took what appeared to be a tiny piece of paper out of his pocket and then unfolded a gigantic newspaper and sat and very ostentatiously read the newspaper during the performance of the piece and then put it away after the piece was done. So it's odd for us because we listen to this music and it sounds actually fairly tame. It has, you know, some beautiful climaxes. There's a lot going on, but it's not particularly challenging. It's not Schoenberg, it's not Webern, it's not any of our modern folks who, you know, go in a totally different direction. It's very much out of that school of Debussy and similar to other Italian music of that period.
I love those descending scales at the very end there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Those are a lot of fun. And I think that's, you actually find that texture quite a bit in his piano music. So that I always have a couple of hours in the morning to practice, which is great, because if I don't schedule that, then practicing it probably isn't going to happen. And then basically the rest of the day is either teaching students, so teaching applied piano students, teaching class piano, which is the large group piano intended for all music majors. It's a required course. It could also be teaching opera workshop, coaching vocalists, working with singers on a one-on-one basis. Next year, I'll be teaching what we call an FYE course, first year experience, which is actually a research methods class intended to introduce people who are new to the collegiate experience, basically teaching them how to be a good college student.
Wow, that's an interesting concept.
It's something that's becoming more and more popular on many campuses. I think now most schools in the country actually have an FYE course, and it's just a matter of making sure that it really serves the students.
Wow. This must be something new.
I think it probably is fairly new. It's probably within the last 10 years. It's something that most schools, again, have created a special office actually dedicated to what they call first-year experience. And the idea, again, is to make sure that the students have the skills necessary to be successful in their studies. So it could be something like, you know, teaching them how to take notes, how to do a presentation, how to use PowerPoint, how to use the library, how to use digital resources, you know, all those kinds of things that I think a professor might take for granted as being something, well, of course, students know how to do all these things, but often they don't. And I think schools are being wise in recognizing that and doing their best to really help prepare students for the collegiate experience.
That is very interesting. I taught at the University of West Georgia for a good long while. I'm not going to say how long. And one thing I noticed is that it takes students approximately a year to a year and a half to get acclimated to being on campus, to get in the feel of how you're supposed to learn. And I think that's really interesting that they have an office that's actually addressing that.
Sure. And it is the kind of thing where it's not just necessarily academic resources, but also social resources. So, you know, if you're a member of an underrepresented population or you're a first generation college student and, you know, college isn't necessarily a natural segue for you coming from high school, we're able to basically refer students to appropriate resources to help them acclimate. And I think that's actually one of the most important things that the FYE folks do.
Well, how about we hear another piece? What's up next on the repertoire?
So why don't we listen to the Sonata Reminiscenza from Forgotten Melodies, Opus 38 by Nikolai Metner. Thank you.
Wow, that was a kind of haunting piece all the way through, especially at the beginning.
So Mettner is what I would call him a cult composer, at least in the United States. Yeah. So he's the kind of composer who you'll find a fair number of pianists who are really interested in his music and who love to perform it, but audiences don't necessarily know his name, and that's actually his own fault. He was a Russian composer who was born around 1880, and he was a contemporary of Rachmaninoff, and they were actually quite good friends. And like Rachmaninoff, he was an amazing pianist, like a really amazing technician, an amazing musician. And the difference was that when the revolution came, Rachmaninoff kind of acclimated. He came to the West, and then he began playing piano recitals. And so in this country, where Rachmaninoff eventually moved, he made a name for himself as a composer, of course, because everybody knew the famous C-sharp prelude. And they eventually knew the second piano concerto and, you know, other certain pieces that he wrote. So they knew he was a composer. But most Americans experienced him as a pianist. So he would go from town to town and tour as a pianist and play not just his own music, but play music by Bach, Beethoven, Liszt, Chopin, you know, all the usual recital favorites that you would see now on a program. And he would tour the country every single year, and he would play about at least 100 concerts a year. And he did this to support himself because he was pretty sure that he wasn't going to be able to support his family just on composing royalties. And so his solution was to play recitals. So Mettner stayed in Russia a little bit longer than Rachmaninoff did. He ended up leaving in the autumn of 1921. And when he came to the West, he was not willing to play recitals that featured other composers' music. So he was willing to play entire recitals devoted to his own music. But obviously, if someone doesn't recognize the name of a composer and the program is billed as all works of that composer, the chance of having a lot of people come to those concerts is pretty low. And so the only concession he ever made was occasionally he would play a Beethoven sonata. So you would get to hear him play, and it was always, I think, the same Beethoven sonatas. I think there were two or three, so like the Waldstein or the Appassionata, and then he would play the rest of the program would be his own pieces. And the sad thing is that his own pieces are very interesting, and they are things that I think many audiences would love, but obviously unless he was willing to kind of branch out a little bit, he wasn't going to be able to build a following. And Rachmaninoff famously said when asked to donate to basically a collection that was being taken up for Mettner, Rachmaninoff said, "Let him earn a living like the rest of us." So pretty harsh, but I think it was probably a fair assessment considering how much poor Rachmaninoff had to work. So his music is really interesting to listen to because it's this odd hybrid of German and Russian influences. He really loved Germanic structures. So what we just heard was a sonata. So a lot of composers already by the beginning of the 20th century had kind of abandoned the sonata form. So for example, Castelnuovo Tedesco, the Italian you heard at the beginning of the program, didn't write any piano sonatas, and most of his compatriots also didn't write sonatas, and a lot of people just abandoned the form. Mettner wrote many piano sonatas, and it was the kind of thing where some of them are short, like this one. It's in a single movement, this one, so about 13 to 14 minutes, in which is following kind of a form set by his compatriot Scriabin, wrote 10 piano sonatas, most of which are in a single movement. But he also wrote many fairy tales. So we do associate Russian culture with fairy tales, and he really tapped into that. And the interesting thing is I think you can hear the music that you hear in the fairy tales sounds very, very Russian, whereas this music, there are moments that I think you would say, ah, yes, this is a Russian composer, listen to that melody. But there are also moments when you might say, this sounds like, you know, someone who maybe is imitating Brahms a little bit. And his nickname actually was in Russia, they called him the Russian Brahms. He uses these structures, and then he also uses quite a bit of counterpoint. For your listeners who aren't necessarily musicians, counterpoint is just the idea of several lines happening at once. So you'll hear a tune happen in one hand, and then it's repeated in another hand, and they kind of are overlaid. And that happens all the time in his music. And again, other composers of his period weren't necessarily interested in continuing with that. They were more interested in writing, you know, very colorful, picturesque music. So people like Debussy, who, to be fair, does use counterpoint, but he hides it, whereas Mentner doesn't hide it. You hear very clearly different lines going on.
Well, it ain't Peter and the Wolf.
That's true. It is not.
And I guess the next piece you were playing is going to be a little more conventional, I would guess. This is Debussy?
This is Ondine from the second book of Preludes by Debussy. Outstanding. Now that our listeners have heard this music, I understand there's going to be a performance that is upcoming very shortly. Yes, on April 16th, a Monday, as part of our Music on Monday series at Virginia Tech, I'll be playing this program, which features some of the pieces you heard, as well as the last Schubert sonata in B-flat, and I'll be doing that in the Squire's Recital Salon at Virginia Tech.
And if somebody wants to get some information about Tickets, parking, anything like that?
You can go to performingarts.vt.edu. The concert is free, so no tickets are required.
Well, Doctor, thank you so much for coming in today. I've thoroughly enjoyed this interview.
My pleasure. Thank you.